We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. This year, Focus, this program, turns 30, and we're marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest shows that we have in our tape archives. And in many cases, these are interviews that have not been heard since they were first broadcast. Most of the interviews that we've done over the years have concentrated on politics and social issues, but we have had the chance to talk with poets and people who write fiction and musicians. This hour, we'll bring you conversations with two musicians who've been part of the folk scene ever since the early 60s, Gene Redpath and Tom Paxton. Tom Paxton's been singing and writing songs now for more than four decades. He's a Midwesterner. He was born in Chicago, went to college in Oklahoma, but his career really took off when he moved to New York and began performing in Greenwich Village. Some of his best-known songs include The Last Thing on My Mind, Bottle of Wine, Ramblin' Boy, and The Marvelous Toy. When we talked in April of 1986, I asked how it felt to be on the stage singing songs to people who hadn't even been born when those songs were first written.
Oh, if anything, it's kind of a source of amusement for me. I mean, I sometimes laugh. I was doing a concert at some college last year up in Michigan, and I was singing The Marvelous Toy, and they were all merrily singing the chorus with me, Zip, Bop, Whirl, and it suddenly occurred to me, it just flashed on me, that I was singing it for an entire audience that had learned it from their mummies.
Yeah.
And, of course, that makes me feel a little old, but then you're only as old as you feel, and I feel very young. So, it's fun when that happens. I like that feeling. It gives me a feeling of continuity that I must be doing something right because I'm still doing it, and people are growing up in front of me.
I want to ask you. You know, I wonder if when people go and see you sometimes, people who might have seen you a long time back or familiar with your songs over a long time might sort of look at you and sort of say to themselves, this guy really hasn't changed. And I'm sure that inside you feel like you've changed a lot.
I hope I haven't. I would hope they would get that feeling. I hope I've grown. But I don't think I've changed. I think if you listen to the newest album and you listen to the first album, I think you would hear the same guy. At least I hope so.
Yeah? You don't think there's...
I don't think my ideas have really changed much. The difference is, I think I plow the same field year after year the way a farmer does, you know, but the crop is never exactly the same, and I hope that there's a little more depth than there was, but, you know, it's the same physical tools, the same voice, and the same, believe me, my guitar playing hasn't improved in 20 years. I don't think I've changed at all.
Yeah. And some of the things that I have read, you know, like reviews of concerts and stuff, people seem to be saying they think maybe you're changing from doing, that perhaps you're doing less political songs and doing more songs that are somehow personal or emotional and have to do with what's going on in people's lives or in their own experience.
Yeah, but on the other hand, the new album, The 1 Million Lawyers and Other Disasters, that's entirely topical. Every song on there is topical, and only two of them are serious, one about farms and the other one about the Rust Belt factories closing. And everything else is satirical. None of it is about Tom Paxton. It's all funny stuff, except for those two songs. Hmm. I think it's, I still write a lot of topical songs. And, yet having said that, the next album I think will be very different, be very much more introspective.
How many people that you knew from the days that you started performing are still performing? Are there many?
Boy, not many. You know, it's amazing. I call it the class of 60 because that's when I got to New York and really dove in head first to this performing life. But I got there in 1960. Dylan got there in 61. Phil Oakes came in 62. And when I got there, Dave Van Ronk was already there. He's a New York guy. Well, Dave is still going strong, and you may have noticed that Dylan is still active.
Yeah, although it's kind of weird to see him on MTV looking like Madonna's dad. That's a little strange. I don't know if that is for
Madonna's
you.
Madonna's dad?
Well, he looks, yeah, he's kind of, I mean, wearing, you know, crucifix earrings and eyliner. That on Dylan looks kind of weird to me.
I wonder how I would look with my bald head, with crucifix earrings and eyeliner. Now, there's an image to conjure with.
Well, you could try it sometime and see how people responded.
I think I can predict how people would respond.
it just seems like it's a very different sort of image and very different kind of material, and that it's a strange. It seems like a different person to me in some ways. And I suppose, you know, if you really know the guy, you would say, well, no, he's not a different person.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I must say, strictly personal opinion, one of the reasons that I like this kind of music, which, for a lack of a better term, we'll call folk music. I play music that I write that is basically founded on traditional folk music forms and with a bit of British music hall and a bit of this and a bit of that. One of the reasons I like it so much is that it's really not tied to any age group, as someone just said in a call. I'm 48. I'm a parent. I have one daughter, a junior at Yale, and the other one just finishing high school. And yet, I'm perfectly comfortable singing any song I've ever written, because they're not specifically youth-oriented songs or anything of the kind, and they're not generationally oriented songs. They're just songs, and I still sing The Marvelous Joy with great comfort, and I still sing the love songs that I've written. They feel fine coming out of my 48-year-old throat. And I think that that's one of the things that the people in rock and roll struggle against. I mean, I even hear a little, you know, defensiveness in, I guess it was some members of the Rolling Stones were talking about this, showing that, you know, they're the first ones to show that you could keep on rocking or things like that. Well, I don't have to prove anything like that. You know, of course I can do this, because it has nothing to do with age.
Hmm. What do you think has kept you going when some other people have quit?
The bursar is a big part of the explanation there. I'm just like everybody else. I have bills to pay. You know, I have children to raise, and I have a family to support. And the way I support it is with my musical career. And it is my career. It is what I do for a living. And it's a good living. I have to work very hard at it, but it's rewarding. And the reason I keep going is because I like what I do, and I believe it's worth doing. And I enjoy doing it. Now and then I have a hell of a good time, really a lot of fun. For example, a Sunday I was flown out to San Diego to be part of a flea market special broadcast from the National Public Broadcasters Convention. And I was out there with my pals Jim Post and Ann Hills and Mary McCaslin, and we put on a live radio show from San Diego and had a walloping good time doing it, and had some Mexican food and some good talk. And now and then I really have a wonderful time doing it. Most of the time I have a good time. Sometimes I have an abysmal time, but who doesn't? But the main reason I keep going is because this is what I do.
Yeah. I suppose you're lucky if you can, 9 times out of 10, have a pretty good time doing what you do.
Oh, yeah. It's beyond luck. I mean, it's really... I don't want to look gift horse in the mouth. I don't know how I got this lucky to be doing something that I enjoy.
Yeah. Well, we'll put you in contact with some more folks here.
Fine.
Hello.
Yeah, I would like to hear his personal top 10 favorite of his own songs, and maybe some comments on what it takes to write his songs or put them together.
Okay. I don't really have a top 10 favorites. Among my favorites certainly would be songs like The Last Thing in My Mind. But there must have recorded over 200 of my own songs by now, I guess, maybe 250 of my own songs. And of those 250 songs, I suppose there are 200 that I like in one degree or another. I like, gosh, that's really hard to answer. Depends. I mean, they're on such different levels of seriousness in my own mind. I mean, I like something like individual verses, the verse in Forest Lawn about the statue that salutes, raises his hat as mourners pass by, and so I like Forest Lawn. I like, although I don't sing it very often these days. I like Jimmy Newman, although I almost never sing that now. I like the songs that I worked very hard on to get exactly the way I wanted them to be, and they turned out that way. I like Born on the 4th of July. I like Every Time. As for how to write a song, we could talk for 2 hours about that. We really could. There are different ways of writing a song. Sometimes I sit down with nothing at all in my mind and write a song that shows I had nothing at all in my mind. Other times it's you just scratch on the paper there and write nonsense down and cross it out until something worth pursuing shows up on the page, and then you see what the next line would logically be after that, and then at some point you see that it's going to turn into a song, and then you begin to shape it, and it's kind of working from the back of the mind to the front of the mind is the best way I can put it. I know they talk about left and right brains, and I don't understand that yet, but I do know that a lot of songs begin on an unconscious level and bubble to the top, and at a certain point the conscious mind takes over and begins editing and shaping. It's all very mysterious, and I think people make it sound too mysterious. I really don't want to make it sound like mumbo-jumbo, although at a certain point there is a little mumbo-jumbo involved.
How much improv do you do these days?
Improv?
Yeah.
What do you mean by improv?
Taking up the guitar and trying it from scratch, right then and there.
Oh, no. What I do with the guitar sometimes, I sit around. I tend to warm up for a concert by sitting in the dressing room and singing old folk songs, you know, on top of Old Smoking and things like that. But I also noodle around a little on the guitar, and I tend sometimes to get a little groove that will turn into a song. For example, a song on the new album called Factory Whistles Blowin', about the all the factories closing in the Rust Belt and the industrial demise, began as a little guitar riff in a dressing room in upstate New York. And by the time I was ready to go on and do that show, I had the chorus, words and music. And that's all I had for, must have been a month. I didn't get any further with it. And then I was on a show, a radio show with Pete Seeger and Oscar Brand and Theo Bakel. And I never get around Pete Seeger without singing a song for him to see if he'll sing it. And I sang in that chorus. I said, "Oh, I like that. Does it have any verses to it?" And I said, "Well, no, actually, I think I'd better write some." So sometimes it happens that way.
Something I wanted to ask you, this just occurred to me last night, maybe it's a weird question, but I confess it was while I was watching television.
No.
And yes, it's true. And a commercial came on, and I thought for sure that the person who was singing in this commercial was a performer of some stature, you know, mm-hmm. a pop music performer. And it occurred to me that
probably
that
was.
It's happening. I think sometimes it's people that just sound like these other folks, but I think in many cases it's the real, you know, it's the genuine item
sure.
doing that commercial. I was just curious, has anyone ever approached you to do a commercial, either to write the music for
a
commercial
sang,
or to do it?
This must be about 5 or 6 years ago. I did a Miller Beer commercial.
You did?
I said, you know, if you got the time, we got the beer. I did one of them. And it's unbelievable when you do one to see. For one thing, it was a lot of fun to do. It was the cream of the New York session musicians. And so it was a lot of fun just as a recording experience. But it paid for a year of my daughter's tuition at prep school. It's unbelievable what can happen with those things. So, I don't mind doing that stuff at all. As a matter of fact, I have an agent in New York, and I go and do auditions for not the singing, but to do the announcements underneath him, these what are called voiceovers. Mm-hmm. And that's just part of being a performer, part of the business, you know. It has nothing to do with when I sit down with my notebook and write what's important to me. None of that has anything to do with it. But it is kind of a game that takes part of my time, is to go around and do these auditions. And, you know, I run into very famous actors in these waiting rooms of these advertising agencies and things. And it's, you know, I like doing it. It's fun, and I hope I get some of them because they pay extraordinarily well, and I could use the money. But they have nothing to do with this at all.
Hmm. Going back in time to when you first started performing, how did you? I'm sure that it, for everybody, I'm sure that it's a terrifying experience. When the first times that you get out there,
out there
with all by yourself with your guitar, and even if it's only, you know, 5 or 10 people, mm-hmm. it's still like it's thousands, I'm sure. How did you overcome that fear at the beginning?
It's very gradual. I really was almost sick with nerves when I started. And the only time that happens to me now is when I'm doing something I don't do very often, like, you know, like live television. It still shakes me up a little bit. But the only way you get over it is by going through it. And that's not very helpful for someone to hear. The thing that I would love to get through to young performers is that when they're feeling that way, when they feel as I felt, for example, the first time I sang at the New Faces concert at Newport Folk Festival in '63, I had the conviction that my career hinged upon how well I did in this performance. And that's a lot of pressure to put on yourself, especially when it isn't so, you see. And if I could get young performers to realize that, hey, I mean, you can totally blow this one. And, it, you know, you don't get sent back to the minors. I mean, you still get to find another performance to do, and you can build on this. But stage fright, which, as I say, I don't suffer from anymore, certainly not before concerts. If you gave me I'm sure the pulse is up a little bit because I'm concentrating, and I want to make sure I do as well as I can do. But I've no fear of anything. I mean, everything that bad that could happen has happened to me many times, you know, forgetting songs, strings breaking, you know, whatever. Sound systems going dead in front of 5,000 people. You know, it's all happened to me. So, and none of it killed me. And that's a great secret to learn. You don't die from forgetting a song. You do not die from that.
Have you had that experience being into a song, somewhere in it, and forget what the next line
absolutely,
is?
Absolutely, totally blank. And then go to another song and forget it, too. And this in front of 6,000 people. Yes, indeed. And not for the last time. You know, I guarantee you, it will happen to me again. And I didn't die from it. I went on and sang a third song, and it went over fine. And then I went and sang another song, and the performance wound up, you know, quite... But if I'd been younger, starting out, I could have totally frozen. You know, what I did was what an old pro does. I went to an old song that I could sing in my sleep, mm-hmm. and I sang that, and that put me right back on track again. But stage fright, I hate it because it really is. I mean, these old vaudevillians, you know, who get on a Merv Griffin show and talk about, you know, if you're not being physically sick in the wings before you go on, your heart's not in it, you're in the wrong, you know. Yeah. I despise that kind of philosophy. I mean, you can't do your best work when you're tied up like that. I mean, how would you like to feel that way before you went on the air every day, you know? And how would you like to tell someone, how would you like someone to tell you that if you weren't losing your lunch, you weren't really a broadcaster. Your heart wasn't in it. Well, who wants to feel that way? That's the only way to do your job is to be sick before you do it.
Yeah.
No, it's I hate stage fright. I think it you don't do your best performances. It's you spend half your time trying to overcome the stage fright on stage, and that energy could go into your performing instead of terror control.
Who do you like to listen to? Who are you, some of your favorite performers? Not only, and maybe I wonder if there are some that are.
I had some really off the wall favorites. Some of my favorites are people like Joan Morris and Bill Bolcom. Did you ever hear any of their stuff on Nonesuch?
Oh, sure.
After the Ball, and I have a real soft spot for a 19th century popular song, and I can trace it back to the summer of '59. I spent in Cripple Creek, Colorado, acting in a melodrama. Right after I got out of college. And the piano player who sang and played the piano before the show, during the show, during the intermissions and everything, was Max Marath, who has since been a very eminent ragtime piano player and made many records for Vanguard and a real authority on that stuff. And I heard Max all summer long, twice a day. And I really took a lot of that in by osmosis, I think. So I like those old songs very much indeed. And I listen to a lot of classical music. I like a lot of Renaissance and medieval stuff, and all the way up through Wagner and things like that. So I listen to a lot of classical music, and of course I listen to folk music. I like the Weavers still do it for me. Pete Seeger, Dave Van Ronk, great many people. Yeah. Bill Staines, who was here earlier this year.